Hello and welcome to The Double Pivot, the world's most agreeable soccer analytics podcast. I am Michael Cayley. We are back. It's been another bit of a tough week, but we are plowing through. And we're talking about what to talk about. And I realized we're going to talk about the top four race. Because the top four race remains a thing to talk about. And it changed. And like the table's lying. And there's analytics. And so here we are back again. Top four race still worth talking about. I'm joined by Mike Goodman. How you doing, man?
I'm doing all right. The music you heard on the way was the Whalers. Max is not with us on the other side of the virtual glass. Please download, subscribe, make us happy as podcasters. Over on the Patreon side at patreon.com/doublepivot, we will be talking about the return of the Champions League, which happens next week. Watch it exclusively if you are in the United States on CBS All Access, soon to be called Paramount Plus. I am a company man, as they say. All right. Before we get to the Champions League, we're going to talk Premier League. It's one of those things where every week the Premier League top four race is the thing to talk about because things change. And yet every week you end up going over the same territory because while the particulars change, the general thing of like, there's a bunch of teams, all of whom are pretty good, some of whom are a little better than others, sort of mixed in there in ways that aren't necessarily apparent, is the same.
Yeah, and so like the thing to start with is that we are now 23 weeks into the season, and the table is still lying, I think, more than usual.
I think there are a lot of times where fairly early in the season, it is statistically apparent what the ranking of the teams are, even if that statistical ranking has not yet become evidenced in the table. Like I think about a lot a piece I wrote for Ringer several years ago, where it was like mid-October, Arsenal were on top of the table, and I was like, oh no, the Premier League is over ish. It's City is slightly better than Liverpool. The two of them are going to race the title, and here's 3, 4, 5. And it was just like readily apparent from the numbers at that point, even if it wasn't apparent on the table. So this year we had for a long time that not be the case. Not only was it not readily apparent in the table, it also wasn't readily apparent in the numbers for a top four or six or whatever. And I think what we've seen over the past month, 2 months, is the numbers have begun at least to sort themselves out a little bit in terms of ranking who we think is very, very good. But given that the table is still a lying liar and we are now 23 games into the season, the difference between what the table says and what the numbers say make it less apparent who's going to finish where. Although that has begun, I think, also to sort itself out in the last month. And that's really what's changed over the last month, is that we can begin to, I think, make more specific guesses about what the ultimate ordering will be as we start to resolve the tension between what the table looks like and what the numbers look like.
You can subscribe at patreon.com/doublepivot to hear more about what happened with Man City and why there is no title race. And that now is sort of generally accepted. The table now shows Man City with a big lead and a game in hand. Pep has done this. It's pretty much happened at this point.
Right. For a while, we were looking at it as like, well, City have like 2, maybe 3 games in hand over relevant teams, are playing way better than everybody else. They're going to win the title, and it will become apparent to everybody else. And now it has become apparent, and they are both on top of the table with the game in hand and playing very much better than everybody else, and that is that, as they say.
Yeah, and so then we've got 2 through 9. And this is where sort of, you know, the lying begins. So Man United in second. Man United have been playing quite well recently.
Yeah,
they're sort of on a run right now where it's kind of like the like low rent version of Liverpool last season, where they keep playing pretty well and winning.
Yeah,
and now Liverpool had lots of games where they dominated. They just also won all the games where they played pretty well.
And also Liverpool won all the games where they played pretty well, and United are winning most of the games where they play pretty well, right? We still have the Everton match from the weekend, which was a wild 3-3 draw. You know, we still have the Arsenal 0-0 draw in there and the shock loss to Sheffield United. Like, they've dropped a lot of points recently, even while still playing pretty well in a way that that Liverpool team didn't. But that Liverpool team was a lot, you know, a lot better than United and finished with a lot more points than United will. But I think the structure of this is right, right? Where it's like United are playing well and also on balance taking somewhat more points than we would expect from the level of well that they are playing.
Yeah. Actually, I think it's worth taking a minute to talk about the Everton game because I think it is a there's sort of a fun analytics thing here.
Yeah, that's true.
I mean, Everton are presently not only are they in seventh place, but they actually have two games in hand on fourth place.
Yes. No, they are over 10% to make the Champions League right now, which we'll circle back to in a bit.
Yeah, and but they were dominated in this match by Manchester United. In great part because Everton are in a deep injury crisis. And Dominic Calvert-Lewin just hurt his hamstring. It doesn't seem like it's too bad, but it's hard to say.
Richarlison was limping at the end of the FA Cup. The wild. Are we going to, like, address that FA Cup match between Everton and Spurs at all?
I mean, I think that it is a nice sort of pairing
With the United match,
because that game was much more up and down. United's control of the Everton match was much more sort of a stranglehold.
Yes.
Whereas Spurs-Everton was like wild and back and forth. But Spurs were much, much more effective at breaking down Everton than Everton were at breaking down Spurs. But Everton scored every time they broke Spurs down.
Yes. Now, I will say that like in that match, what we saw was that like, that gets reflected in the XG, right? Where Everton were like clearly not as good in terms of the balance of chances created, and it just didn't matter on the day. Where like the United match, you have this fun little analytics tension, which is.
So what happens in this game is that you've got this. United are in control of possession, are dominating the shot count. The ball is just sort of living in their attacking half, final third, and. But you have these couple moments of just, like, huge breakdown. You've got Calvert-Lewin gets in behind at 2-0 and plays sort of a ball across that De Gea just sort of, like, nicely pats down for Doucouré to finish.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's pretty clearly a keeping mistake one way or the other. I mean, you can argue what exactly the mistake was. But it is a keeping mistake which allows Doucouré to just literally tap into an open net from like point blank range.
Yeah, the second goal is some reasonably nice play and a very nice finish by James, and the third goal is the very last play of the game basically, and it's just a ball into the center of the penalty area that no one defends well, and Calvert-Lewin gets at the end of a deflection.
Right. But so the XG thing here is that what you have here is very, very few opportunities for Everton, all of which lead to high XG chances. So you look at the totals at the end of the match, and the total and the XG is fairly equal. And you look at the chances, and the XG is a fair representation of those chances. But then you take a further step back and you look at the balance of play, and you say, well, boy, the amount of XG that Everton generated from the balance of play was way, 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 way towards the top of what their range would be. And like, some models attempt to deal with this, right? Like, 538 has their possession-based version of a model which goes into everything, which is more or less just looking at, like, how often you have the ball in the final third versus how often you take chances. There are other more... But what we know is that, in general, like, XG is a better representation, right? But that doesn't mean that when you look and break down an individual match, you can't say, ooh, boy, Everton really did get lucky to create the volume and quality of chances they did given possession. That's a fair thing to say about an individual match.
Right, and what I would like, the non-shot XG that exists in my head is one where a team that concedes lots of possession in the final third, but does a pretty good job preventing like progression into the penalty area, and several times in the match has a break where they get into space and really create dangerous counterattacking opportunities, and the XG ends up about even. In my head, there is a non-shot XG where that is reasonably even. But that is not this game.
Right.
This game, what happened was United screwed up twice.
Yes, that is correct.
And so, like, the fairness of the XG isn't a reflection of Everton's strategy. It is a reflection of a couple of mistakes by Manchester United. And this is one place where I think it's hard to sort of get your mind around exactly what that means, because I think that, like, there's something very true about this, that soccer is a game where you can do everything right for 89 minutes and you can screw up for 2 minutes and you don't deserve to win. Because those screw-ups are so large that 89 minutes of good stuff is balanced out by that.
That's right.
At the same time, those screw-ups are not something that Everton really did.
Right, and, like, to be fair to United, those screw-ups are not something that you can depend on United making. Like, not to be, like, too trolly here, but United aren't Spurs. Like, Spurs' defense has not been good this season, and they make a lot of mistakes fairly frequently. And United's defense has been fine. And you don't necessarily expect that without putting them under a ton of pressure, they will gift you chances, and they will make these mistakes. And that is one of the things that is quite difficult to model, I think, is this idea that, like, there would be teams who you could sort of play like Everton played against, and you'd be like, well, they're probably going to make a couple of mistakes at crucial moments, and you'll have chances. And maybe in a given match, those chances will develop, and maybe they won't, and maybe you'll score them, and maybe they won't. But in general, like, there are some teams that will make mistakes that could, in theory, allow chances and good chances and goals more than other teams. This is not like penalties, which are truly random. But teasing that all out is incredibly complex.
Right. And like sort of what you default to is just like going back to your aggregates.
Yep.
And you've got Manchester United with like a plus 19 goal difference and a plus 11, plus 12 XG difference, excluding penalties. And like, just a good team that has a few more points than you'd expect, and that's just going to make it really, really hard. They are going to have to do a bunch more screwing up like they did against Everton.
Yes.
To really be in danger in the top four race.
Right. Also because they're in second, so like the other the other option of teams behind them getting really, really hot, it would have to be like three teams. Or I guess like one team could get like kind of hot, and then like two teams would have to get really hot, depending on where they are on the team. But like a lot of stuff has to happen behind them if they are not actively pulling a Leicester from last season.
Exactly, and those teams have to like balance it out. Like Spurs and Aston Villa both have a game in hand. Aston Villa have two, but like it's Spurs against Aston Villa. That's the game in hand. That's how games in hand work.
Right.
Like only so many teams can make up ground that way.
Yes, it can't be that everybody behind you in the table is going to win.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's United. They're in pretty good shape, and I think that is, you know, sort of reflected in all of the metrics that you can find in general, all of the predictors. They're like 538 has them at 84% to make the Champions League. Like they're in good shape. Then we come to Leicester in third.
Leicester in third.
Who are pretty good.
Yeah, 3 points on third, 4 points on three points on fourth, 4 points on fifth. Like, the thing is that, like, Leicester have had this weird structure to a season where they got an incredibly large amount of penalties while playing pretty badly.
Yes.
And they have, as they've gotten healthier, they've gotten somewhat better, although it hasn't totally come together yet. They're still
they've actually like not had a very strong last month at all in results. Right, they've got like a draw against Everton, they've got a loss to Leeds at home, they beat Fulham, and then they drew against Wolves, who are not a very good version of Wolves right now. And this is, they have, well, I guess Vardy missed a chunk of that time, right? So that's, and he's now back, so that's part of it. But like, this is another team, like, I feel like we keep coming across these teams where we're like, yeah, they're pretty good, and they're doing pretty well, and they've got, like, a points gap. And then you look at the results, and you're like, but, like, are they? Are they actually winning a lot of matches? And, you know, in Leicester's case, not really, right? Like,
yeah.
It is,
and I mean they've only got like a plus, they've got a plus 37 shot difference. They've got a plus 33 shot difference, and but they've allowed about as many high quality chances as they've conceded.
Yes.
So like their shot advantage is mostly James Madison firing from 25 yards, rather than like they've been pretty average, and they haven't quite gotten everyone fit at the right time that all works together.
I guess what I'd say is this. Their season is weird in that they take a mm-hmm. lot of points when they were playing poorly without any of their good players. And then they have improved to being a pretty good team, but have not continued to like take a lot of points. And so there's a reason here that 538 looks at them and says, well, you're only 40% to make the top four and really the fifth most likely team to make the Champions League spots, even though you're in third. And I don't really disagree with that. I think there's a Leicester team in there somewhere that is a good team, like a second or third place team. We haven't seen it. I'm skeptical we're going to see it. Part of it because they have a little bit of like high class Everton syndrome where they have a handful of very good players, but they're all rotatingly hurt and the rest of the team is not good enough. Like, they're not deep enough at midfield. They're probably not deep enough at fullback if you think about, like, is Pereira ever going to play? And they're not deep enough behind Vardy when you consider the fact that it doesn't seem like Iheanacho ever gets minutes. So, they're good. I think there's obviously a lot of worlds where they finish top four. But if I were to say to you that there's going to be a really exciting race coming down the stretch of the Premier League season for the top four spots, I think a big part of that is Leicester coming way back to the pack.
Exactly. You kind of like almost need them to not come back to the pack too quickly.
Yeah. Well, right. What you don't want is like Chelsea and Liverpool just coasting into those spots. And then it's like Leicester on the outside looking in and that's that. The question is basically, can you get a wide open race for fourth?
Exactly, and Leicester City also have Europa League,
right?
So they are they're it's going to be like the story of this Leicester season working out is one where they manage to finally get, you know, Castagna and Pereira and Vardy and Ndidi and Madison all on the pitch together regularly,
yes,
but you kind of can't do that if you're playing twice a week. And that's where they're at.
Yeah, right? I mean, like, it's not even like their good players fall on the Iron Man side of the... I don't know. Like, United have Bruno Fernandes, who's very important to them, but seems to be a guy who can just play every 3 days, all the time. And none of Leicester's players are like that. Madison isn't, Vardy isn't, Barnes maybe is the closest, Ndidi isn't. Like, all these guys are in and out of the lineup a lot. Some for age, some for fragility, some because they happen to just play a demanding role. Like, it's a mix of reasons, but this is a fragile group without the depth behind it to sort of ride being fragile.
Yeah. But at the same time, they are in 538, 40% to make the top four. They if you look at the betting sites, like they have a reasonable shot top four. It's because they've got 3 points and 4 points on the teams behind them.
Right.
And those teams behind them, I think this is, you know, I continue to be like zero worried about Liverpool.
Same.
I mean, the thing is that they are at, like, 538 is just at 75% to qualify for Champions League, which is, like, a significant chance of them not qualifying for Champions League in that model. I think I'm just a little higher on them than that.
I don't know. I think we may just be a little bit lower on everybody else. Honestly, than 538 is, because 538 still ranks them as like their SPI is like 88.8. They're like, it ranks them as very, very good. Like, just mildly, well, I guess I get this point a little bit more significantly worse than Manchester City. But, like, clearly better than United and Chelsea, right? Like, clearly the second best team by a very strong team. So I think maybe when we sort of eyeball it, we're just kind of like, no, all these other teams we don't think have the capacity to do this. But it also may be that, like, I don't know, like, Liverpool are one significant injury to those front three away from real questions, I think. So, and, like, everybody's getting hurt this year, so.
Yeah, it's maybe worth talking a little bit about the City game because, like, they got pretty well whooped in that match.
Only in the second half, actually, which was interesting. Like, the first half was just, it was, like, a very classic dull half of two good teams who are not interested in taking risks. And then Liverpool got whooped in the second half. But, like, I think that you walked into halftime of that match, and I don't think Klopp would have been upset by the City miss a penalty, but it was a little bit of a flukily created penalty. And Liverpool, like, they only had two shots. Liverpool outshot them, like, they outpossessed them. Like, I think that, like, Klopp would be fine with that half, to be honest.
I think that's fair. It was very much two teams. Like, City were looking to, so City start Zinchenko and Cancelo.
Right.
So it's kind of the same it looked to me like they were hoping to run the same strategy they did against Chelsea, where, like, you just can't take the ball from us.
And it didn't work in the first half.
It didn't work. Right.
Now, like, Liverpool didn't create a ton off it, right? Like, five chances, none of them all that great is not, like, a lot of creation because City are a very good team. But, like, they did thwart City's plans in the first half.
Yeah, and I think that, like, part of this was about having Thiago and Jones in midfield. Liverpool, one, they're just a very good pressing team, and they were able to disrupt City enough. And then, two, they have so much passing in this team. And then with Henderson and Fabinho at center back, like, it's just really hard to get them off the ball.
Yeah. And then,
and that's kind of, and they weren't trying to do that much with it. They weren't trying to break with the ball, but they had, they've got four guys in the center of the pass who are really good passers, and Wijnaldum, who never loses the ball. And, like, and that was one of the reasons the game was, I thought, pretty boring in the first half, because Liverpool actually managed to run a possession approach that, like, nullified City's press and possess approach.
Yes.
Which is not a great thing to watch, but it worked for 45 minutes.
And then in the second half, to me, what was interesting about that match is, like, it was just a pure example of the fact that Liverpool don't have center backs. Because City only took six shots in that second half, but they scored four goals because four of them were big chances, because every time they got into the penalty, right? Like, City's attack is constructed to beat center backs, right? Like, it is constructed to attack from the sides and create cutback opportunities and make center backs have to make plays to win the ball off of you in those positions. And Liverpool had Jordan Henderson and Fabinho at center back, who are perfectly acceptable options when you have center backs who don't have to be playing center back. And then City forced them to a handful of times, and because they're not center backs, City decisively won those moments. Phil Foden absolutely wrecked people a couple of times to create those cutback and scoring opportunities, right? Like, it was just a matter of City effectively exploiting Liverpool's injury weakness, I think.
Yeah, and then, like, on top of that press working, Allison just sort
and then
of
right, passed Allison
the ball to them
apart
a couple times, which, you know, not recommended.
Yeah, I mean, Allison really fell apart. Like honestly, so he really made, like, three big chances, and only two of them turned into goals for City. And I have, like, I do suspect that part of this was Guardiola winning a little tactical trick over Klopp, in that it seemed to me there is a specific pass that Liverpool ask Alisson to play where they reverse the ball and Alisson plays it to the far side fullback in situations where you wouldn't really expect it, and nobody's really pressing the far side fullback because it's a dangerous pass and Alisson is accurate and the fullbacks are good, so they do that a lot, and City just sat on that pass. And the first time it was a warning, and then they didn't stop doing it. And I mean, it is true that Alisson had a terrible match making those decisions. I think it is also true that Alisson in the moment and Liverpool on a whole reacted very poorly to City having a specific plan in place for his very specific kind of distribution.
Yeah, and while City were doing this, and even when Liverpool managed to get a penalty and equalize, their attack still really struggled to do anything with all that possession. There wasn't it wasn't clear how Liverpool were going to break down City. And a couple of times that Liverpool did manage, I think Firmino and Salah, there was a moment in the early second half where Firmino manages to turn, I believe Diaz, turn Cancelo and then he and Salah are running at the defenders, but it's 2-on-3,
right?
And the next two trailing players are both City players,
right?
And like, it was just such a clear example of the way that City, they're playing Zinchenko and Cancelo at fullback, but what they're doing is using it to play a sort of 2-3 or 3-2 back,
right,
who don't move forward very much.
Right.
And so there's always going to, in the end, there's going to be three guys behind you, and there's going to be five in that range, and it's just really hard when you're attacking with just three for the most part to do anything about that. And then if you send the fullbacks up, you are putting your center backs exactly in the position they don't want to be. It is a... It's just, again, this is the City approach working.
Right. I mean, part of City this year being very much better than Liverpool is that Liverpool can hang with you for a half and sort of have a half that they view as successful. And then in the second half, the talent shines through and the approaches shine through. And the fact that Liverpool are just that much better, you know, shines through. So.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think that's a fair way of putting it with Liverpool, which is that as bad as the injuries have been, this team continues to perform even with this City match at a level that looks good enough for top four, but one more injury?
Right. Or like one more just sort of like, we have a month where we have Champions League matches and we just sort of scuffle and drop some points in a handful of Premier League matches in a row against teams behind us that maybe don't have that. Although, there's only, like, I guess that's West Ham and Everton, really. But, like, okay, we'll get there. So should we move on down to fifth place Chelsea here? Because I think this is actually kind of interesting.
Yeah, definitely.
So Chelsea earned fifth. They're 39 points, while Liverpool have 40 and Leicester have 43. They've all played 23 matches. They are ahead of West Ham only on goal difference. And part of what's happened is that Thomas Tuchel has come in and had a draw and then a bunch of wins. And drawn three wins in the league. And Chelsea all of a sudden are in 538's model, I think in a lot of people's minds. If not more likely than not to get top four, at least one of the top four most likely teams to get top four, right? 538 has them as the likely fourth place finisher with 48% chance to finish top four, which is the fourth highest number. But coupled with that is like, yes, Tuchel's gotten results since he's come in, but this team has not exactly like played all that well.
Right. They what they have done is possessed very, very well.
Yes.
And the possession has led to three games where they've conceded basically nothing.
But it...
Now, they've been playing pretty weak attacking sides.
Yes.
At the same time.
Also true.
But they have conceded very little because they've constantly had the ball. But we are not seeing Thomas Tuchel's attack work.
I mean, it's...
And I have some questions about, like, to what degree this is about the teams they were playing. You're just going to have some slow, boring games with teams that are difficult to break down when you're playing, like, you know, Wolves and Sheffield United. And to what degree he is doing things to make the possession work defensively that are not going to be as effective, that are making the attack work less well in a way that's going to continue to be an issue and could become an issue against teams that are better poised to sort of blow up their possession.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it is still too early to look at him and be like, okay, this is... At some point, when managers come in, you flip from... They are not doing what the manager envisions that he wants this team to do eventually to, okay, well, if this is not what the manager wants, he has had ample time to have them do something else and they are not. So it is either what the manager wants or he's incapable of getting what he wants. And we're still well away from that point with Tuchel, right? I see a couple of things, but the majority of what I see is his formations right now, which are basically 3-4-3, but the attacking three has one reference point and two guys that kind of run around that reference point, are like the end point of what his possession schemes have looked like frequently over his career. You know, I think I've joked around with you about this off mic before, that like he oftentimes starts his teams in one formation. And then you get the ball and you do a whole bunch of moving around and interchanging to pry a team apart. And by the end of all that, you are more or less in this 3-4-3 with three players in possession at the back, two players very wide and advanced, two midfielders sort of pulling strings, and three attackers in the middle attacking the box. What he's done is basically said, well, I don't have time to implement my whole system. So why don't we just start at the end point of where I want all you guys to get to after building the attack? The problem is that when you do that, you don't do any of the things that pry apart a defense, right? That create the chances to you for you to exploit from that formation. I don't think that he's like unaware of this. Like, I don't think this is Tuchel making a mistake. I think this is Tuchel being like, I came in the middle of the season. This is what I can do. And this part of it, where we just basically play sorry ball, is working well enough right now. And, like, the hope is that as you go, you know, rather than Christensen starting at the middle of three center backs, you end up having a guy who is more of a center back slash midfielder in that role, right? I remember when I wrote the piece about how Tuchel operates, there were some Chelsea fans who I thought rightly asked, well, that seems like Christensen is a guy who could be, like, dusted off from the mothballs and play that kind of role. And I was like, yeah, that's possible. And what we're seeing is kind of that, right? With Thiago Silva getting hurt, they've put Christensen in the middle center back role because that's where he's supposed to end up in the session.
Rather than converting him to a defensive midfielder like Marquinhos,
right?
Rather than seeing in Weigl that you've got someone who basically is that while he's a midfielder,
right?
You sort of just keep him at center
right.
back,
and you know, like I think all of this is fine as long as it's moving towards something, and as long as you're like, and nobody cares if you're getting points while you're doing it. That is one of the trickiest things for a manager to come in and do is to say, like, okay, we're going to implement a whole bunch of stuff, but we have to have midpoints along the way. And if you're not getting results while you're going through that process, it can become really ugly really fast. But as long as you're getting results, you're going to give yourself the goodwill and the time to continue walking down that path. But circling back around to like the top four race, what's interesting is that while Chelsea are favored by 538, because they have a lot of good stats and because they are now getting results, a lot of the reason 538 likes them is because they thought they were a better team under Lampard than those numbers showed. And so it is interesting to me that like if the worm turns just a little bit here with Tuchel's sorry ball, like what happens?
Yeah, and one thing that's going on with this, with the Chelsea team right now that is kind of interesting to me is that what one thing that Tuchel has done is really pulled back on. This team is full of playmakers. One of the problems with Chelsea's summer in many ways is that they bought too many playmakers.
Yes.
And you don't, and there isn't really a good way to fit them all together. And Lampard was sort of trying a bunch of things to get them on the pitch while also trying to figure out how to have someone to play with Timo Werner, because he has in the past been better playing with somebody. And Tuchel has come in and really isn't playing any playmakers. Pulisic comes in as a sub. Mount is bearing the brunt of the creative responsibilities. Werner is often playing with another striker. It's Werner who creates the goal against Sheffield United. He's the one guy who's got like really plus shot creation totals in his career. And it is like one thing that you would think could happen in a team like this, where they're just set up to defend with possession, is that you'd, and this is what happened with Lampard, is they'd be set up to defend with possession, but hopefully Ziyech in particular would do something. And Tuchel has taken that option off the table, but their defense in possession is much, much, much better. And so it's kind of just like balanced out. It's one of those interesting things where like managers can have a really big effect. I can imagine a world where a manager figures out how to get the most out of this team. But right now what Tuchel is doing is adding things to the table with this defensive possession and taking things off the table by not having the kind of shot creation that Lampard kept forcing in there.
It's interesting, and like he said, Tuchel said yesterday at his presser that like he thinks Ziyech still needs to adapt to the Premier League and like the competitiveness of the Premier League, and like that's not really true. It's not true statistically, it's not true by the eye test, like it's not. And if you want to tell me that like, he's putting up the same numbers in the Premier League that he put up in the Champions League and Europa League with Ajax. Now, you want to tell me that, like, Ziyech needs to adapt to what Tuchel wants him to do? Like, that's fine. And, like, you should never put too much statement in what a manager says. Like, managers just... they say shit. They just say shit. But it is interesting that, like, he can't get in the squad. Like, it's more interesting to me that he can't get in the squad than, like, that Pulisic can't get in the squad, which I like didn't expect but can sort of understand given the mash of bodies.
And Pulisic has gotten off the bench a bunch of times. True. Like he's playing.
Yeah. I don't know. It's all, there's a lot going on, but there's a lot to figure out and it's a tricky situation. And as long as he keeps winning and none of this is a problem, but if he doesn't, it can become a problem. And the thing is that we all need Chelsea to not keep winning if there's going to be a really interesting race, I think. Because what you have here is five teams from City on down to Leicester, all of whom have a 40% up to 100% chance of making the Champions League, right? But the remainder of the possibility is split fairly evenly between West Ham, Tottenham, Villa, Everton, with a tiny little scooch of Arsenal. Let's just talk about Arsenal for a second here, because there is something very interesting in 538's numbers, which is that SPI thinks Arsenal is the fifth best team. They think they are slightly better than Leicester in the Premier League, which I did not expect to see.
I mean, I think one thing that's going on here is that Arsenal absolutely dominated their Europa League group.
True.
So I often when something looks a little bit unusual, you can then go and look at them putting up 4xG on Rapid Wien and be like, okay, that is having an effect here. They absolutely rocked their Europa League group on and the thing about that is that, like, I remember the last time we were talking about something like that.
And it was Manchester City.
Yep.
Yes. Now, look, there was a real stretch here where I think Arsenal looked like they were really coming on quite strongly, kind of like from Christmas through mid-January-ish. Mm-hmm. And then they proceeded to draw United, lose to Wolves, lose to Villa, right? Which is not, like, an end-of-the-world stretch by any means. But when you have been, like, so bad over the first chunk of the season that you were like, boy, I don't know, are we going to have a relegation fight? And then it turns out you're actually not that bad at all, and you're pretty good, and you get a whole bunch of results. You've put yourself so far behind the hole that even, that's kind of mediocre three-game stretch sort of dooms you from, like, a competitive standpoint.
Yeah, one thing I also wonder about in this context is how much the schedule just makes it really, really hard to go on a run, because, like, the level of everyone is just lower.
And everybody's closer to each other. Yeah, which means that you just need to get luckier to... Basically, it means not getting unlucky requires more luck.
Yeah, and you can't keep the same 11 guys on the pitch at all times.
Also true.
Especially if you are going to be in the Europa League, which Arsenal are. Which I feel like is a good point to switch it over to the teams that are not.
True.
That could conceivably, with fitness, just keep playing the same 11 guys down the stretch.
Well, there are two teams. Three teams, I guess.
Yep.
West Ham and Villa and Everton. We just skipped right over West Ham a little bit here. They're tied on points with Chelsea in fifth, a point out of the Champions League spots, and, like, they're not bad.
Yep. They had this last weekend. They have been clearly trying to put out teams out there that can win these games, and they had a huge win over Aston Villa in the midweek.
Yes.
And then just they put out an attacking team against Fulham and just looked exhausted and didn't do anything.
No, they got pretty manhandled by Fulham, like, if we're being honest. I think the shot count was like 20-8 or something along those lines. And yeah, I mean, I think there's two things going on, which is that, one, Moyes is obviously more comfortable as a manager when he is reactive, right? When he is, you know, counter-attacking and counter-punching somebody else who goes out with the game plan to beat him. So I think that is part of what we're seeing. But then also in that Fulham match, they just looked pretty wrecked.
Yeah, and Antonio picked up an injury. I think he's not out too long, but, like, I think the other big thing here is that, like, everyone's picking up a muscular injury.
Yeah.
This last weekend was just been a meat grinder. And so West Ham they've got Sheffield United this weekend, but then, and they'll be playing, like, just every week. They don't have a lot other games. They're out of the FA Cup now. They've just got this, but they've got Spurs, City, Leeds, United, Arsenal. Then Wolves, then Leicester. Like, they have everyone over the course of March into February, March, and April. It's just all of the teams.
Yeah, I think probably the way I would look at this schedule is, like, what that indicates is that they have moved up from the ninth-ish range to the fifth range, because they have had the last 2 months, month and a half, a fairly easy schedule. Now, we did just finish talking about the fact that, like, Moyes is more comfortable playing teams that are trying to beat him than teams he has to try to beat. But that is not outweighed by the fact that teams that are trying to beat him are better, usually.
Yep. I mean, I think the one thing that is, if they can get fit and be playing the same 11 every 7 days while other teams are rotating their 11 every 3.5 days.
Yes.
Like, that is the story for this West Ham side, who is just, I mean, again, like, just not that far off from being as good as some of the other teams. They're clearly worse than Liverpool. They're clearly worse than...
Just so David Moyes.
Yep.
Not that far off from being as good as the good teams is, like, the canonical David Moyes.
Yeah. Maybe this is the year that it works out.
And
then you've got Aston Villa, who have been playing the same 11 every week.
Yeah. And they have two games in hand, which is on the one hand, why the table is lying to you about how good they are, because they're, like, probably better than West Ham and a little bit worse than Leicester. Like, a little bit worse than Leicester would be, like, my assessment of how good they are. The two games in hand is, like, a double-edged sword here because, like, it cuts against just running out the same 11 every week, right? But also it means that, like, the fact that they're lower in the table isn't really a problem.
Yeah, and then their XG difference is significantly better than Leicester's, or a little bit better than West Ham's, better than Spurs, better than Arsenal.
Yeah,
like,
yeah. I think there are reasons to question some of this, but not like a ton of it. Ewan wrote a really good piece this week over at StatsBomb, sort of breaking down like what is happening in terms of Aston Villa's dramatic improvement. I think there's a little bit of a false sense around Villa because they have the games in hand that they are one of these teams that like starts off hot at the beginning of the season and is kind of surprising, but then like fades down the stretch and doesn't really have and like there's no reason yet to believe that about Villa, right? Like there's no reason yet. The only reason they have faded numerically in the table is because they have played two less games. That like in a world where they had played two more games, they would be, your expectation would be right where West Ham are, basically, which is, you know, tied for fifth with one team ahead of them in Leicester, who is probably not as good as them. Probably. Not definitely, but probably. I mean, the thing about Leicester and Villa here is we spent a lot of time talking about how Leicester have a couple of very good players who keep getting hurt and they can't all be on the field at the same time. And that is why they are maybe not that good. And like, that's no different than Villa, except that the players don't get hurt.
Exactly. This is not a team that I think can fade an injury to basically anyone in their defense. And certainly not a team that can fade an injury to Watkins or Grealish.
Right. Obviously, Grealish and Watkins are the big two. Maybe now, because you have Sansone, like, you can fade McGinn a little bit better than you thought you could have. And then, like, I think they have a third center back, right? Because, like, Mings got hurt for a bit, and
Yeah, it's true.
But I think they're fullbacks they need, so. And obviously, I mean Martinez as well. Like, anytime you get a goalkeeper on that list, it sort of suggests where you are, right? But, like, Villa are good. Villa just remain good. And I think that they have, in a weird way, like, the fact that they are so, that they are like a full two games, like behind everybody else on the schedule, has let them, like, has let the hype around them fade in a way that, like, they get to, like, cruise to being top four contenders without anybody noticing, which is really unique for a start, for like an upstart team. Like, you just don't get the hype of, like, that two-week span where seven places write a feature on you, right? Or, like,
yeah.
Because, and it's purely just because of the number in the table, irrespective of everything else.
Yeah, their being ninth lies to you in, like, the single most straightforward way.
Right.
Like, they just haven't played the games.
Yep.
And Everton, the thing is, you could say the same thing about Everton because they're like ahead of Aston Villa with the same number of games in hand.
Yeah, except they're not good.
and the reason we're not talking about them is that they are also dependent on a few great players who are all hurt, and so they don't play well.
And yet they have still kept managing to get these ridiculous results. So, like, I personally am not going to complain. But there is, to me, I mean, I guess you could tell, like, the fairy tale story where everybody comes back for the home stretch and they're only playing once a week, and except that they freaking beat Spurs, so, like, they still have to play those FA Cup matches.
Classic mistake.
Beating Spurs, the classic mistake, Kelly says. Nobody should fall into the trap of beating Spurs, says Michael Kelly. Yeah, but, like, you could tell that story about Everton. But you have to understand when you're telling that story, you are looking for the perfect slice of their range of outcomes. Like, it is a little bit interesting because that slice of the range of outcomes involves probably their XG being significantly better over the remainder of the course of the season than it has to date. Whereas most times when you're looking at overperformance, what you're arguing is they're going to overperform their XG for whatever reasons that you want to construct when you're talking yourself into your team. But it is still the case that you're like, well, sure, James could just play at like on two legs instead of like maybe half a leg at best every week. Or, you know, Richarlison will be at his, like, all of them. Like, and it's just, I don't know. Like,
yeah. I mean, the thing is that we saw it for about five games.
Right. No, we absolutely did. And like
we, it's, it, you're not, with Leicester City, we're a little bit making it up. I mean, we saw Leicester City do this last season for a period of time where they were clearly a solid top four team. And they are now with this same squad just not playing that well, but gain the points anyway, which is a nice situation.
True, but
to
then,
be in,
I mean,
so you don't have to dream on as much.
But Leicester's baseline is still like higher than Everton's is the thing. Leicester's baseline when they don't hit the, you know, when,
yes,
when they don't roll double sixes in terms of injury outcomes or whatever, is higher than Everton's. It's just, Everton has also gotten those points in the same way that Leicester has, while like having like a lower like performance level when all the guys aren't on the field.
Yeah, so like and the difference between them and Aston Villa is that Leicester have to get their, is that Everton have to get their players healthy, which is like not a trivial thing to do.
And
it's a lot easier to imagine a team being fit when their players currently aren't injured.
But also like Everton have to get and keep their 28, 29, 30-year-olds healthy, except for, I mean, Richarlison and Calvert-Lewin, who are the guys who have stayed healthy. Richarlison had a suspension earlier in the year. But like, you know, James and Alan, like, these guys are older. Digne is, like, a little bit older. Like, Seamus Coleman, who they need at right back because they don't have any other right backs. Like, these guys are older. Whereas, like, Grealish, Watkins, these guys, you know, even Sansone, who they just got. Like, Barkley, who was hurt earlier. Like, they're younger. Like, it's easier to keep them healthy.
Yeah. And for the most part, they also, the Aston Villa system is like, it's made for the fullbacks to be able to play every week and just sort of keep going and be fit.
Yeah, I don't even know what the Everton system is made to do at this point, to be honest. I know what Ancelotti's like ideal system is. Like, I know how that one is supposed to work. I have no idea what like the, you know, the amazing amount of stuff he just keeps throwing at the wall and somehow walking away with results are right now.
Yeah, so I mean, I think that like the basic story here, and it's one that we need to get Tottenham to fit into, but the Tottenham fit into pretty well, is that we've got one great team. We've got what appear to be three very good teams. But those three very good teams, other than United, have too few points to make it obvious that they will just easily take top four. And on top of that, they're not so good that them dropping a few points here or there, them getting a little bit of bad injury luck here or there, opens it up. And so it's sort of talking about like Leicester, West Ham, Everton, Villa, and Spurs as teams that have varying different levels of ability to luck into taking one of those teams out or be in position when something goes wrong for Chelsea or Liverpool and get that. And, like, that's just where Spurs are, too.
Right.
Like, and
I mean, I think
Harry Kane appears to be fit.
Right, yeah.
So, like, the story of this season where it just all falls apart because Kane gets injured, that doesn't appear to be the case. And so that just sort of puts them in this. This is what we're talking about on the subscription side pod about Jose Mourinho, that, like, all of this has gone wrong, but, like, they still got Kane and Son, and they're, like,
in it.
Even while they keep making all these defensive mistakes, they defend so much. They're a pretty good defensive team with Kane and Son.
Right. Now, the thing that I would say, one thing I'd say about Spurs is, like, if you were to pick one team that's likely to pull the plug on the Premier League to focus on the Europa League, it's Spurs, clearly. And, like, I'm not even sure that's wrong. Like, if they win, if they are in the quarterfinals of the Europa League and they have a, you know, 15-20% chance of the, like, I don't think that that's a wrong decision, necessarily. Even in what is a stacked Europa League this year. which we'll talk about at some point when we have the time. The other thing I'd say in general is the way to look at this race is that, like, the modal outcome is quite clear, right? Like, the modal outcome is obviously City, United, Chelsea, Liverpool. The modal race, like, what the race looks like coming down the stretch is quite clear. And that is Leicester competing with those four spots for a fifth spot. But there are, like, just because those are the most likely races to happen, there are a lot of worlds where even if the top four is four of those five teams in, like, a fairly boring way, there are a lot of these other teams, some of them get in the, really, in legitimately in the race for periods of time. And, like, it is, like, in some ways much more interesting that you have, like, four teams here in West Ham, Everton, Spurs, and Villa who are, like, possibly popping into the race than if the race itself was flatter and more competitive between the top five. Because, like, there's just a lot of worlds where the race... Like, a few weeks ago, we were telling you, wow, this race is fun. Then, like, some stuff happened and the race is less fun right now. But there are a lot of worlds down the stretch where even if the result ends up boring, the race itself is, like, fun and unpredictable to the end point.
Yeah. This is not our last top four.
No, it's our last top four until at least next week. I will say that, like, part of what's happening too is there's so many, like, two match weeks that, like, a lot changes from the time we talk 1 week to the time we talk the next week, double as much as normal, and, like, that is going to now slow down as we get into the Champions League and Europa League portion of the schedule.
So that's where we'll be, and we'll see you next week. We'll have more pods about the Champions League and the Europa League. Patreon.com/DoublePip for a few more of those, and yeah, thanks for listening. Thanks for subscribing.
All right, cheers, y'all.
Cheers.